Back at it with you Monday, December 7th, 2020 on Connecticut Today. John Carbone joined us in the 3 o'clock hour from Access Health Connecticut. He manages the side of the Obamacare portal in the state that deals with businesses. Governor Ned Lamont issued his latest coronavirus briefing in the 4 o'clock hour. 5 o'clock hour, UConn Law School grad and Army veteran Kevin Howard joined us. He's an economist, and he warned us about what would happen if Congress did not issue enough coronavirus relief and or stimulus heading into 2021. I kicked off the show, speaking of coronavirus money, talking about the fact that the state, in my opinion, had better ramp up payments to businesses harmed by coronavirus shutdown. The plight, as we have been talking about it, boys and girls, sons and daughters, mothers and fathers, over the past months here, the rumors of these massive lockdowns coming up as this second wave of the coronavirus hits us, and it's as bad, if not worse, than people think. But you heard from these restaurateurs. You hear from these restaurateurs all the time, not just nationally, but into and through the greater Bridgeport area here, Fairfield County. You know, if you go with lockdowns, and it's going to be interesting to see what Governor Lamont says today. We talked about it last week. There is more and more pressure on him to lock down indoor dining, so we'll see what happens. Story that's bubbled up over the past day or two, and we told you about this story that popped up several months ago with some of the early shutdowns or lockdowns on dining. The story of a local restaurateur, Christine Casey, owns Casey's Irish Pub in Milford. And I spoke with her attorney several weeks ago when she filed her lawsuit. Neither of them wanted to come on at the time. But you see this story today by Lisa Backus in the Post. Hemorrhaging personal savings. Milford bar owner first to take her COVID appeal to the Supreme Court. Now, this is not the United States Supreme Court. This is the Connecticut State Supreme Court. So coming up this week, as it says here in the paper, the state Supreme Court is set to hear its first pandemic-related business case. This is a big deal, boys and girls. It's filed by a pub owner, as we mentioned, Christine Casey in Milford. A lot of people I know have patronized her establishment, including, I believe, my producer. She claims they've been paying over $3,000 a month in rent and other ancillary costs since March when the governor shut bars as the coronavirus pandemic began to spread across the state. Now, again, you can argue all of the epidemiological and medical, you know, scenarios of this whole thing. Fine, go ahead and do that. How I will ask the question again and again and again, because this is the question now that hopefully is going to be cast upon the state Supreme Court. And finally, people are asking this nationally. There's a big issue that people have to look at here. Yes, one of the issues is keeping people safe and healthy. Now, we know ways to do that. We know that the vast majority of people who unfortunately succumb to the coronavirus are over 60 or 65 years old. Yes, there are deaths in younger people. We know this. I read about one of them a couple of days ago. That's not to be minimized. But every doctor I've interviewed on this show, everyone we've heard about locally or even on the national news, say that the overriding people that actually need to be quarantined here are those in their upper to mid to upper 60s and those with other conditions here. But as her attorney said, who I spoke with a couple of weeks ago, Jonathan Klein, says Casey is hemorrhaging personal savings and borrowing from her father to try and stay afloat. She has not been able to secure any loans through the Small Business Administration. She's fast running out of funds, and the shutdown forced upon her by the governor's executive orders will put her out of business if it continues much longer. And that is, again, the question. And even when this is asked of by the governor and other governors, you get a little bit of tap dancing, you get a little hem and a haw, and well, you know, what are these people supposed to do? What are these people supposed to do? The attorney, Mr. Klein, here contended in this case when it was first floated here. Let me see if I can get this back where it was, as my screen decides to jump on me a little bit. The attorney for the bar owner here contended in the lawsuit filed in Superior Court that the governor does not have the authority under the state constitution to issue executive orders, and whatever power he's been granted by the legislature violates the separation of powers. The owner of the restaurant here, Ms. Casey, seeking a temporary and permanent injunction barring the governor from issuing any further executive orders on drinking establishments and striking down the orders related to bars and restaurants that have been issued since March. So we'll open up with that question. You want the bars and restaurants closed, and you want no more indoor dining for a segment of time here. You want the bars to remain closed? Fine. Pay the owners. Pay the owners. Well, Paul, the state doesn't have the money for that. I don't care. Pay the owners. Figure it out. Borrow the money. We borrow and bond for a lot of other stuff that we don't need. We bond for hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars in some orgy and orgasm of spending every year in this state when we know we can't afford it. How about we bond? How about we borrow to keep these poor people afloat if they're going to have to contend with these orders? I don't understand it. And then we get people up there sometimes, like the governor and other legislators, saying, well, you know, we're trying to help these people. No, if you order their business closed, you better damn well figure out how they pay their bills and they don't go into financial ruin because of something you ordered. I'm sorry. This is really, I understand the epidemiological and the medical considerations of this. I'm not going to sit here and say I don't. But look at what our buddy Scott Dolch says all the time from the Connecticut Restaurant Association. They're saying several hundred restaurants have gone kaput good. There are another 1,500 to 2,000 that are threatened here. Nobody seems to care. No. Let's bond money for a whole bunch of other. Let's bond money for playgrounds in the state. Why don't we do that? Yeah, that's great. Meantime, people who pay taxes to the state, they get squat here. At least that's what I see. 203-333-9422. 333-WICC. 216. All right, 203-333-9422. 333-WICC. And I always encourage folks to email me if they agree, disagree, or not at lowercase, all one word, CT today. CTTODAY at WICC600.com. So I just get this email. I'm not going to say who sent it. I don't publicize people's names, but I do, you know, if it's sent to me, I will read it. Somebody just wrote to me. Here's the email without a town or a name, guy or gal, but it's in the area. I am writing to tell you how disappointed I am in your show today. Driving around 215, you went into a rant about a bar owner in Milford taking her case to the state Supreme Court and how she can't pay her bills. Okay, yeah. I do not mean to be insensitive to her dilemma. However, we must all do our part to slow the progress of the virus. Okay. Her business, like many, are greatly affected. Okay. Many businesses are suffering, and quite frankly, we are all suffering and somewhat isolated. Okay. My disappointment is that you should be using your platform to make your listening audience safer by suggesting isolation, mask wearing, and social distancing until a vaccine is distributed and we can all get back to normal, which I've been kind of doing for the past 8 months. So I don't know what I should be saying. I've been saying over the past, if this person was listening closely, I have been also saying over the past 2 or 3 months, put your holiday gatherings on hold. For just this holiday season, everything will be fine. I've been saying wear your masks. I've been saying I wouldn't fly in an airplane. I've been saying be nice even if you're outside. Just because you wear a mask, stay from 5 feet. Be empathetic to her situation, but know that sacrifices businesses like hers are making Connecticut a safer place, period. Okay, fine. How does she pay her bills? How does she pay her bills? See, instead of blaming her or blaming me, blame everybody from the governor on down through the General Assembly, whatever, or the feds. How does she pay her bills?
That's my question. You can shut everybody down for as long as you want, fine. How do they pay their bills? That was my point in my quote-unquote rant. That you have a lot of people saying, well, just shut everybody down. We've got to get by this virus. Yes, we do. Yes, we do. How would you feel? Put yourself in her shoes, or the shoes of a lot of other business people that I know, or the 600 or 700 restaurants that have already shut down in this state. Empathy, empathy. And yes, before you say anything, I know 3 or 4 people in my life who have lost relatives to COVID-19. I know another 3 or 4 people who it was a close call, but their relatives were saved. So please, I know. It's like when I talk about gun violence, I've also had somebody in my family killed by a gun, so I know. But my point is, very simply, that when we just tell people, shut this down, shut that down, okay, fine, fine. How do they pay their bills? Because as I said 6 or 8 months ago, unless the feds or somebody comes in and says, okay, everything's free until next summer, there's going to be hardships. Right? I know you can't put a value on the comparison of a human life and a couple of drinks in a bar. I'm not saying that at all. What I'm saying is we need to stop being short-sighted at this. And maybe instead of pointing fingers at people who are honestly trying to save their livelihoods, we should maybe point more fingers at people who are just not taking this thing seriously. How about that? Huh? Talk about another aspect of the Affordable Care Act and Access Health CT. This is Access Health CT Small Business. Is Director John Carbone who joins us. John, hi. It's Paul here at WICC in Bridgeport. How are you?
Good. How are you doing, Paul? Thanks for having us.
Well, it's my pleasure, and I know this is an important time, and I had a guest on a few weeks back, John, regarding the individual sign-ups for the Affordable Care Act and Access Health CT. But from what I understand here, there's also, and I guess, John, a lot of people might not know this, there's a small business aspect to that as well. Talk a little about that.
Absolutely. There is an additional small business part of this. And what we do is we help small businesses throughout the state of Connecticut with 50 employees or less look and find the best affordable health care plan in our bucket, or we point them in the right direction outside of our bucket to basically find something that can fit their needs and their employees' needs.
Now, as far, John, a few weeks ago that I was told a little bit more about the individual plans available here, there weren't that many on the individual side. What are the options roughly for somebody who may be looking as an employer, John, in that stratosphere that you mentioned, folks who may be looking for options here? Talk a little about the options you have.
Not a problem. It's a great question. We currently have 2 carriers on our side, and it's ConnectiCare and Anthem, and we offer about 10 different plan options. They're out there. It's mostly to understand, I always kind of give everybody the kind of scenario. It's finding the best plan that's going to fit that employer's needs and that employee's needs. But going through that, we have plans that we offer from all the way from gold plans to bronze plans. But it's, again, it's about understanding the needs of the employer and the needs of the employee to make sure that he or she best finds the best plan that fits their needs.
So is, John, the idea here behind the Access Health CT Small Business Portal looking for those options that may be a traditional, bigger, corporate-based employer might not be able to meet as far as price and affordability?
Well, here's what we do a little bit different than the marketplace does, is we'll sit down with that broker or that employer and understand what they're looking for. Price is always, especially for an employer, today's economy and what's going on with the pandemic, price is their price point and, you know, what they're looking for and how they, you know, want to budget on a, you know, 1 to 3 year basis. We'll sit down with that employer and broker, explain the different types of plan options. The employer may be looking for a price point plan, but we offer multiple different options to that employer. And I'll give you an example. If there is an employer group that has three employees, we're going to offer all five plans that one of those carriers can offer that those three employees. The employer picks the plan that they can benchmark and create that contribution strategy, which is what that basically means is what the employer can afford. Mm-hmm. But then the employee goes and picks the plan that best fits their needs. You know, a 20-year-old may want a bronze, or someone who's looking more for a co-payment plan may get a silver or gold. It's that flexibility that creates, you know, the need that the employer is offering those plan options, but that employee gets to be empowered and pick the plan they need.
Okay, John, hang on. We'll be right back with you. A lot of questions still for you. John Carbone is the director of Access Health CT Small Business. Now, you can check him out on the web, accesshealthctsmallbiz.com. Another portal of the Affordable Care Act, but this one is aimed towards small businesses. John Carbone continues with us. John, hang on. 336 Traffic and Weather Together on WICC. It's Access Health CT Small Business. It's a portal somewhat similar to the Access Health CT portal we talked about a few weeks ago when the enrollment period began, but you can check this one out, accesshealthctsmallbiz.com. And John Carbone runs it. John, a few more minutes with us. And John, other than price, and we all know as consumers, you know, and business people, whether it's a T-shirt or a new truck, we look at price. It's a major aspect. Other than price, John, what are some of the aspects that a small business person comes to you and talks about, or comes to, you know, your insurance people and talks about here? You mentioned deductible, for example. I guess that might be one of the major aspects here.
Yeah, absolutely. So employers come to us and ask us about different types of options. You know, what type of, you know, tax credits can we use, pre-tax dollars? What we have different in our bucket is small businesses could be eligible for a small business tax credit. So a for-profit can potentially be eligible for a 50% tax credit. A non-for-profit can be up to about a 35% tax credit. That's only allowed in our bucket. So if there are employers out there who potentially kind of meet some of these small criterias, 25 full-time equivalent employees or less, they average $55,000 or less on an annual salary based on everybody, they could be eligible for this, you know, this small business tax credit. We always kind of say, if you're kind of fuzzy about this or you kind of need some insight, talk to your CPA or give us a call. Come and visit us at the small business CT website, you know, and give us a call, and we'll gladly walk you through it.
And that's interesting. You mentioned there is on some of these considerations, John, an average salary mark that does come into some of these computations.
Yes, there does. So, you know, what they do is they kind of accumulate, if there's 10 employees that are eligible for this small business tax credit, they take that average salary. So there could be someone that makes $70,000. There could be someone that makes $35,000. If they fall below that $55,000, then that's they could be eligible for that small business tax credit. It also, you know, it excludes the owner through the equation. So it helps them meet those criteria. It doesn't exclude the owner from health insurance. It just excludes their salary out of the equation. So they have a better chance of maybe hitting that that tax credit.
Okay, so the dollar core is really based on that core of whether it's salaried regular workers or hourly workers. As you say, it kind of peels away the owner and maybe the VP of people who might skew the equation, I guess, John, is the worry here?
Yeah, it's owner or anybody related to owner. So it definitely does it. I agree with you. Yes, Paul.
What are we talking about, John, as far as sign-up periods now? Because I know so many of these things. We had a period beginning for individuals in Access Health CT. I know there's a Medicare period going now. So if folks are interested in the Access Health CT small business portal here, time frame, what are we looking at here?
Our open enrollment is the beginning of every month, so we're open all year round. We always tell employer groups and brokers, our broker community knows this very well. As we go through this process, we want to make sure we have enough runway so the employer and the employee understands what they need to do. So for us, we basically say the beginning of every month, but we'd like to have it, you know, to walk through everything 30 to 45 days before that first of the month. It just allows everybody to acclimate and understand all the different options. Because, again, what we do a little bit different is if they fit in our bucket, fantastic. If they do not, we like to guide them to where they need to go. We like to be that concierge for them to say, there are other plan options also out there for you, and you may want to think about this, this, and this. So at the end of the day, we're here to serve those small businesses in the state of Connecticut.
So unlike the Individuals for Access Health CT or the traditional, you know, large for-profit companies who, you know, have their employees say, okay, you got to get your benefits done by X date. You folks do it every month. I did not know that.
Well, we do it every month. Once they lock into that beginning of month, that renewal then is a 12-month period. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we can bring in new groups every single month. But once that group signs up, they're locked into those rates for the entire 12 months.
Sure.
And we can definitely, from there, talk about different options with them and all that. But we're allowed to have what the individual has during a certain time. As we all know, the individual market is, you know, kind of currently right now, December 15th. So please, if you are an individual, definitely go to that website, take a look at that, and see if you're eligible for any help on that side of the fence. But for us, employers can come. Different employers can come to us every month.
Is the John Carbone, is the age-old theory in insurance buying, is it still prevalent that the more people you have buying into any policy or any group, you know, group buying indicates better rates? Do you find that? I mean, no matter who it is, whether it's an Access Health policy or one of the big companies, maybe even somebody paying out of their own pocket, is it really strength in numbers here still as it's always been?
So in the small group market, the rates are based on age. There's no healthcare statements. There's no pre-existing condition price add-up. So it's based on, so if the small group has one, the price is the same for one or 50. Those theories kind of work out in different, what we call mid-size and large-size groups. Mm-hmm. But in the small group marketplace, the rates are the rates regardless of the situation.
Interesting. So that must put people at ease. Do you find, John, that you have people coming to you on a monthly basis who didn't think they could afford something or there was something feasible and it ends up working out for them?
Yes, especially during this time. A lot of individuals, a lot of employers have kind of taken the approach wrong, you know, with their brokers, especially during this pandemic. They're feeling a need to have their employees covered. When we're sitting down with them, mapping out the concept, the strategy over the next, you know, 1 to 3 years for them, they're realizing that this is something that's affordable. This is something that they can do for their employees. This is not a burden that they need to all pick up on themselves. And there are some, you know, nuances for them on, you know, using pre-tax dollars versus mm-hmm. post-tax dollars that they may not be aware of. Well, we always tell new people who don't have new employers who don't have health insurance, call us. We'll walk you through the process. We have individuals that we've been talking to for an example, someone we've been talking to for over 13 months. They yeah. just signed a policy for 1-1 because that's when they felt comfortable and they were able to establish their budget and establish their strategy.
Interesting. John, what's the contact number and the website as well that we could tell people about then? How do people get more info?
Absolutely. They can call us at 860-241-8445 or visit us at accesshealthsmallbiz.com.
John, thank you. John Carbone, the phone number 860-241-8445, 860-241-8445. John Carbone, director of Access Health CT Small Business. Check it out on the web, accesshealthctsmallbiz.com. So not only does Access Health CT, the portal for the Affordable Care Act, apply to individuals, it applies to businesses as well. John Carbone, thank you. Have a happy holiday season, and we'll talk down the road. Thank you.
You do the same, sir. Thank you.
Thanks, John Carbone there from Access Health CT Small Biz.
7-day rolling average. So keep watching that trend. Across America, the average is about 10.5%. Give you a little bit of perspective. I was checking our neighbors. We're a little bit more than Massachusetts. We're a little bit more than New York. We're a lot less than Rhode Island and New Hampshire and New Jersey. And Pennsylvania is at 35%. The good news is, I think, what was spiking in the upper Midwest just a few weeks ago looks like it's leveling off. So we're watching these numbers carefully, as are you. Next chart. All right, here's another eye test for you, but I thought it was interesting. This goes back from June till today. And the number one metric, of course, we all follow is hospitals, because hospital capacity is key as we figure out what we do going forward. I think you can see on this chart, going back to June 1st, yellow are the admissions. Admissions is a key metric in terms of what's going on in the broader population. You can check infections, but that's sometimes tied to testing as well. Hospital admissions is key. So you can see back in June, we don't really have great numbers before that. We are a little less than 50. You can see of late, our admissions are north of 150. That's on a weekly average. The light blue is the discharges. And that net number is the most important number that we look at as we try and figure out our capacity of our ICUs, capacity of our hospital beds, and stress upon our healthcare workers. And if you can really squint, you can see that light purple line, which is like the rolling hills of Litchfield County. And you can see that over the last a month, it's gone up and down. You can see over the last week that net number of folks in the hospitals has been going down just a little bit. So let's watch that trend pretty carefully going forward. It's worth noting that half the people going into the hospital are over 70, but half the people are under 70 and as young as 20 and 30 and 40 years of age. Sometimes there's some other conditions, including weight, that can be a contributing factors. So be careful, and whatever your age, you can still be infectious. So that's what's worth remembering. Let's go to the next one, Melanie. We spent a lot of time on Thursday talking about vaccine. We're continuing to prepare for that. Deirdre and Reg gave you a good outline of our priority populations, focused on keeping people safe, keeping our nurses and doctors able to keep going and maintaining capacity. That's our primary role over the course of the next 6 weeks. And we think most of that population, almost all of that population, should have their double dose by the end of January. So we have got our orders in for the Pfizer vaccine, subject to the absolute final approvals, which are scheduled any day. You probably saw that Britain, they've already made all the approvals, and they start the vaccinations. I think it's as early as tomorrow. We'll be about a week, 10 days behind there. 16,000 doses going to the hospitals, 16,000 doses going to the long-term care partners about a week later, just to make sure they're ready to deliver the vaccine as needed. And we'll be making weekly orders going forward, tracking carefully our ability to administer the vaccine, demand for the vaccine, and the supply of the vaccine. And finally, tonight we're doing our executive order on providers who can administer this vaccine to make sure that it's the pharmacies, big and small. It's Mighty Walgreens, it's CVS. Also, your small, independent, local pharmacies. It can be the federally qualified health centers and other locals. So we're going to be getting them up to speed, ready to go. So as we ramp up our capacity for vaccinations, we make sure that we can get those administered. The next one is just, I wanted you to see this because there's been longer lines at many of our testing facilities. We've got a lot of capacity. I think you can see that we're third most in the country, right behind Massachusetts there. Some of the other states, we're doing three times more than Alabama and Pennsylvania and some of the other states. So there's a lot of variability in terms of how much testing each of these states is doing. We're prioritizing it for underserved populations, doing everything we can to stay ahead of that curve. And finally, COVID has had a lot of impact on our communities, and it's not all reflected in the numbers. It's reflected in some of these headlines that I think are indicative of the incredible stress upon our communities, upon our families, and many of you. I was interested that dentists are reporting a great increase in broken teeth and chipped teeth and people gnashing of the jaw and what that indicates. The advocates are warning us about domestic violence ticking up quite a bit, addiction ticking up. I'm afraid gun owners are warning about a potential suicide and what that means. We've seen a lot of shootings in many of our urban centers and beyond. These are all signs of the stress that many of you are going through, which I think is worth remembering. There's some happier things. You know, home improvement is surging, and everybody who's at home are finding some constructive ways to use that time they have as well. Home sales are heating up coming in from New York as people may be looking for a little more outdoors, a little more privacy, assuming that their days of quarantine are not necessarily over. My kids pointed out a headline about dating in the pandemic. It's like a Jane Austen novel, Look But Do Not Touch. So a lot of things are changing, and we're going to be careful for a little bit longer. I noticed this evening, Monday Night Football is not at 9 o'clock. It starts at 5 o'clock. So much is changing. But there's one person here who can tell you in a very personal way how COVID is impacting people's lives. Manisha from Yale School of Medicine has talked to hundreds of patients. She's been in the hospitals, mainly at Yale New Haven. Many are reaching out to her. And she's had a chance to reflect on those informal personal interactions, how people realize they maybe got infected, how they realize after the fact maybe they've infected others, and some stories that I think it's worth all of us reflecting on as we go through the final quarter of this pandemic. Manisha, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Governor Lamont, for inviting me and providing me with this opportunity to speak with the public. I'm Dr. Manisha Jutani. I do not represent my employer or the hospital where I work, but I am here today to talk to you as an infectious disease physician and to share some of the stories that I have heard from patients that I have helped care for and people that have reached out to me. So, you know, Governor Lamont's leadership has helped us get this far in this pandemic, and we're going to need it for a while longer to really help us get through. But there are so many things that everyday people like you and me can do to really make a difference in terms of who we are really seeing in the hospital. So to share a few stories with you, the first is one I wanted to tell you about six young people. So in their 30s, as Governor Lamont mentioned, it's a tough time to meet people when you're young right now, but they decide to go out to dinner together. And you can imagine that all six of those people are coming from different households. And one of them lives with her 67-year-old mother. And so that 30-something-year-old who gets infected at that dinner party then goes home and infects her mother unknowingly. And that patient then becomes my patient in the hospital. The second example I wanted to give you is of a woman in her 70s. She lives with her son, who's also in his 30s. And that son is very careful because he knows he lives with his mother, who's in her 70s. However, he has a friend who's a neighbor. And that neighbor goes out, you know, routinely, like young people like to do. But he also then goes over to his friend's house for dinner a couple times a week. And that woman in her 70s cooks him dinner a couple times a week. So he unknowingly, probably mildly infected himself, went on to infect the 70-plus-year-old woman who, again, was a patient of mine. And the third example I want to share today is that of two women in their 70s. We know for many older people, they've been sheltering at home. But many older people also live alone. And these two women wanted to share each other's company. But they don't really know all of the activities of each other. Turns out, they decide to go get takeout together. They drive in a car together without a mask. They get some food to take out. They go back to one of the women's homes and eat a meal together. After that, they both are infected with COVID-19. We don't know whom infected whom. And neither knows where they got infected from in the first place. Probably just their activities of daily living. One of them goes to the hospital and is discharged within 5 days, after two visits to the hospital, actually. The other one has been in the ICU for now almost 3 weeks, and I hope she recovers. So I share these stories with you because, as an infectious disease doctor, what I know is that certainly mealtimes are a major high-risk event when transmission of this virus can occur. Certainly high risk in a restaurant because you could be around others as well who are infecting you, but still even in a household environment. And there are so many things even young people can do who unknowingly may go on and infect older people that they know and care for without really meaning it. We want to trust those that we know and that are dear to us. But unfortunately, this virus is equal opportunity, and we all have a chance to get infected. So thank you for that opportunity, and I'll open it up further to the governor.
Hey, thank you, Manisha. Manisha's sticking around, and you just remind me, I can't mandate common sense. People say, make this go away, set the rules. And as you just remind us, all the little things that make a big impact in terms of those informal social interactions. And Manisha's here as well as Josh and Paul. Let's take some questions. Max?
NBC Connected.
Good afternoon, everyone. Any indication on the likelihood of people in Connecticut willing to get vaccinated? Has there been any improvement at all, or do we have any numbers?
The numbers I've seen show some modest improvement, as people are feeling a little more confident. They hear a lot more. They see that Britain has approved it as well. They're starting the vaccinations. So I think you're going to see an increasing percentage of people not only willing to get vaccinated, but wanting to get vaccinated. But right now, the number is still probably in the 70s. And obviously, the more people that get vaccinated, the better. I think that's going to change over time.
And you talked about the executive order regarding providers. Do providers have the capabilities to administer, given that the vaccine has to be at a certain temperature?
Yeah, they have ramped up for this. They've prepared for this. I almost brought up the Pfizer box today with the dry ice in it so you can see, give you a sense of how it's being delivered right now. And yes, that's exactly what the providers are trained to do.
And then I'm just wondering how the response has been to Step Up Connecticut, and wondering if also Manisha Jutani could speak to that as well, just about the exhaustion level that maybe she's seeing.
Josh, do you have current numbers there on Step Up Connecticut?
Yeah, we've seen a 500% increase in hits on the websites that we use to collect volunteers and to try to direct new staff to our schools, to other volunteer opportunities, and to our Medical Reserve Corps. So, you know, it's been great outpouring of interest and support so far. But Dr. Jasani, do you want to comment on the staffing dynamics at Yale New Haven?
Absolutely. And what I would say here is that volunteers are very welcome. However, critical care physicians are trained over decades, and they are a very revered resource. If you have COVID-19 and you're critically ill, you want one of our pulmonary critical care doctors taking care of you. And with the influx of patients that we have had, we only have a limited resource of that. And that is part of the reason why so many of us physicians signed a letter asking for certain measures to be put in place, because particularly in our ICUs. We only have so much staff, nurses and physicians, who can really take care of patients the best of our ability.
So just to be clear, Manisha Jutani, you are part of that group that is asking for restaurants and gyms to be closed?
So I was one of the letter writers, signer of the letter that was sent to the governor, and we appreciate the governor meeting with us after we signed that letter. I am in favor in terms of not recommending people going to restaurants. I think that there are many places that will need to be under consideration. I understand the governor has to weigh a number of different considerations, but I do have significant concerns. That's part of the reason I'm here today, to try to ask the American people to partner with us to be able to put a dent in the curve of this pandemic. And changes, I think, are going to have to happen.
Thank you so much.
Channel 3 Eyewitness News.
Yes, Governor, you know, where we stand today with around 1,200 hospitalizations, is this where we want to be in this point in December, or is the virus outpacing our efforts to control it?
I think we knew that that period of time after Thanksgiving, we were going to probably see some increase in infections, and we saw the increase in infections. We see that reflected in hospitalizations. I was talking to Scott Gottlieb again today. He certainly predicted that infections and hospitalizations could go up over the next month or so. So we are watching that carefully. We say, is this where we want to be? No, of course it's not where we want to be. Is it totally unexpected? I think we're ready.
Got it. And a follow-up from last week. Do we know how many businesses have gone out of business during this pandemic?
We've seen the restaurant report that 600 have gone out of business in the restaurant industry. I'm afraid I haven't gotten the current number on terms of more broadly what's happening. Frankly, many of them are taking a pause, and many of them are closed now, hoping to reopen again as soon as we get on the backside of this pandemic.
And my final one, this is a little off topic. Foxwoods and DraftKings, they announced their partnership to bring sports wagering to Connecticut. Is there a timeline as to when that could be legalized in our state?
Well, I'll start and hand that over to Paul, but no, there's no timeline. They have a marketing agreement, which is fine, in anticipation of sometime we'll be able to allow sports betting and fantasy sports here in the state of Connecticut. I've seen that negotiated with around other parts of the country, and it's something we're working on very actively.
Resumes and business cards, far better than mine will ever be. Our first guest this hour is a U.S. Army veteran who later became an economic analyst and a commercial banker with, get this, Husky fans, a law degree from UConn. He served a one-year commitment as a FEMA Disaster Assistance Loan Officer, currently lives in Washington State. Economic analyst Kevin Howard is the guest. Kevin, hi. How are you, sir?
I am doing very well, Paul, and you brought me back to the day with that intro. I happened to be there in stores when Rebecca Lobo won the national led us to the national championship. So, yes, thank you for bringing me back a few decades ago.
Yeah, time does fly. You watch those highlights and you go, man, I was there and I was so much younger, right?
Right, exactly. But no, it's a pleasure to be here to talk to you today.
Yeah, and we should mention your website, theuniversalonenessblog.com, theuniversalonenessblog.com. Now, from your economic analyst viewpoint and your banker viewpoint here, Kevin, where do we stand, particularly nationally on the global scene with COVID here? I mentioned going into the top of the hour here, strange times. I mean, you know, we have restaurants closing here in the state, people locking down all over the world in turmoil here, but yet the stock market is doing well. We've got home prices going through the roof here in Connecticut. Explain all this to me.
Yeah, it is a bizarre time. And but where we are is, well, what COVID-19 has revealed America to be is a country of 60% haves and 40% have-nots. And the demarcation between the haves and have-nots are, you know, people who live paycheck to paycheck, and do not have the capacity to pay a $400 unexpected bill. Okay, so that's 40% of the households in America, yeah. Right? Now, the good news about that, or if there's any good news about that portion of America, is many, many of those people, at least half of them, are essential workers. So their employment is secure because they're essential, right? What is the underpinnings that is at risk in our economy is the non-essential have-nots and small business owners who tend to fall into the haves, people who have savings, people who have more resources, right? Right now, it is those have-nots who are non-essential, right, who and those small business owners who are failing, right, that is the massive risk of the economy. And the tragedy of this is we already were doing the right things in April, in March. When the Congress passed the CARES Act, the $2.1 trillion original stimulus package, all the economic analysis after that act passed said that we put enough money in the average person's hands that when we sheltered in place, the U.S. economy did not collapse, because it could have, right? It didn't. It absolutely worked. Yeah. But the problem is we let that stimulus expire. So pandemic unemployment assistance expired at the end of July, and the payroll protection plan, you know, the last loans were accepted the 8th of August and closed the end of August, which means that subsidy to small businesses, right, expired no later than the end of October. And so we have massive small business failures. I mean, the number of small business operating in the United States right now is down 29% from January. And for anyone earning $27,000 or less, their employment is down 20% from January. Mm-hmm. It's the people who are doing better in the haves, the 60,000 and above, they have recovered full employment. Right. So we have two Americas going on here, but the size of the America that's falling off the cliff is going to pull everyone down. That's where we are.
Yeah. And Kevin, I know exactly what you're talking about because, you know, I've been on the air throughout this whole thing. And when this thing got nasty and I said, well, OK, we have this, you know, $1,200 maximum. It got scaled back from some people, you know, the one time payment and the PPP Act and all this. And a few months after that, I said, well, you know, we're going to need more of this. I mean, this can't stop. I mean, what are people doing here? And the fact that only now, Kevin, are the two sides in Congress coming together with something that's about $900 billion, knowing we're going to need more, this just drives me crazy.
Oh, it is. But this is what we always do. So without digressing too much, if we go back to the Great Recession, 2008, the bailout TARP, okay, we had and it's Democrats and Republicans, right? We had Barack Obama suspend his campaign, not John McCain on the Republicans. Barack Obama is the one who suspended his campaign to come back to the Congress in September of 2008. And lead Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats in the Congress to support George W. Bush to pass the $700 billion bailout of Wall Street. Okay, while then he got elected, and then millions of Americans were allowed to be foreclosed on their homes. They lost their savings, they lost their credit. I mean, and that's what happened to the average person. But the people who caused the problem, right? They got bailed out. So here we are again. So, as I said, they were doing they did the right thing with the CARES Act. But even if you look at how the CARES Act, the proceeds of that were used, it was just enough for the working person to get by for April, May-ish, you know, into the summer, right? But where the lion's share of that money went is businesses, is the 500 employees and above businesses, the big businesses in Wall Street. Because in that $2.1 trillion, there's another $4.25 trillion that was authorized that goes to that is controlled by the Fed and the Treasury Department that goes to the biggest businesses in America. So while the average person is struggling in the actual Main Street economy, Wall Street is blooming because the Federal Reserve is giving them trillions of dollars directly. right? So here we are today, yeah, talking about scraps from the table, $900 billion in a context where you have 70 million Americans who are in that have-not group that's non-essential. 70 million Americans are in that category, right? Okay, they're talking about establishing unemployment assistance of $300 a week, not the $600 that actually worked, but $300 a week. They're talking about maybe a little more PPP, the payroll protection plan for small businesses. But let's be clear, large businesses poached two-thirds of the PPP money the last time. Right. And no changes in the rules. So they're not helping the average person. And the thing is, this will have a catastrophic effect. You know, if 2020 is the year of COVID, 2021 is the year of the economy.
Okay,
and that's what's coming next year.
Hang on, let me get some business done here. We'll come right back. Economic analyst and lawyer Kevin Howard is the guest. We're going to ask him a little bit more about what he sees for the economy, and we'll talk about China coming back as well. Kevin, hang on. Traffic and weather together. 5:16, more with Kevin Howard, UConn grad too, at WICC. Economic analyst with a law degree from UConn, U.S. Army veteran Kevin Howard. We continue with him for a few more minutes. Kevin's blog, the Universal Oneness blog.com. Kevin, let me ask you this. If 2020 was not an election year, so if we did not have an election a few weeks ago, but we still had COVID, would we have had, do you think, one or maybe two more COVID relief packages passed? How much did politics have to do with this?
You know, I'm inclined to say that economics had to do with this. And here's the thing. And we never know in real time why our government does what it does. We usually find out years later, maybe find out years later. But so what I'm going to do is I'm going to speculate in real time. What is going on here? Mm-hmm. Given the magnitude of the economic damages to small businesses and individuals in the country, again, many, many people are doing well, but like 70 million people are not. And many, many small businesses are failing. So given that stretches across the country, Kentucky is not doing well. So, you know, as California was not doing well. So yeah, you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Okay. So given the fact that no politician in this country can look to their own electorate and think that they're going to get an advantage from not doing a stimulus, right, should illuminate a possibility that no one's talking about. It's possible that they don't have a choice. See, here's the problem. We got $27 trillion in debt.
Yeah.
Okay, that's where our federal debt is right now. And when we were going to renew the next stimulus package, the big movement to renew the stimulus packages was in July. And what had happened is, and Congress was pretty confident. If you go back and look at the news reports, there was a lot of confidence as we were getting into the third week and fourth week of July, mm-hmm, that we were going to extend PPP and that we were going to have another lump sum payment. And they were debating 2,000 or what have you, or what have you. And then discreetly, well, to people who don't watch financial news or what have you, China announced if the Federal Reserve continues to dilute the U.S. dollar, mm-hmm, they will sell U.S. debt now. And then all of a sudden, the parties in the Congress couldn't come to an agreement, and they went on recess without an agreement. I mean, if anyone just go back and check and see the 180-degree turn from the third week of July to the end of the month. And ever since, now the parties are confused over whether or not 300, 600, what have you, when there's not a credible economist in the country that didn't say that the CARES Act and the pandemic unemployment assistance actually worked. It helped the economy. It was important. It was worth every cent. So they know the solution. They're not doing it. Why they're not doing it. So my thought process is we have run up too much debt. See, when the Federal Reserve injects money, they just print it.
Yeah. It's so it's monopoly money. It doesn't have any value.
Well, historically, because we don't have a gold standard, money is now valued based on the productivity that produces it.
Yeah.
But if productivity is down, and you're producing trillions of dollars of money, you're diluting the value of the money.
Yes.
So now take now put yourself in China's position. I know we love to hate on them, but Great Britain is in the same spot, by the way. Any foreign government who holds U.S. debt, and foreign governments hold $7.1 trillion in U.S. debt, okay? So if you're holding U.S. debt, it matters to your economy.
Sure.
Right? If you get paid back in lower value money, you're expecting to make some money on lending money, not get paid back in cheaper money, you know, or in other words, negative interest.
Even the communists, Kevin, understand that. They understand negative interest, right?
Right. And so here's the thing. So if China, but what happens if China sells our debt now? So they have over $1 trillion of our debt. If they start selling U.S. treasuries now, that will drive the purchase price of the treasuries down, which since the payoff date, we pay the treasuries at date certain, 10 years, 5 years, 1 year, what have you, mm-hmm. right? What since that's set and the face value of the treasury, if it's a 10-year $100 treasury, you're paying $100 in 10 years. That's what the government's paying you back. So since those things are fixed, if the less you pay for it now, the higher the interest rate, you know? And so if they sell U.S. treasuries now, it will blow up the federal budget because we are already paying 20% of our budget in interest.
Wow.
1 percentage point in higher interest rate, and we will have a monetary default on sovereign debt in the United States.
Kevin, let me ask you one thing here because we're up against the time-wise. In about the 60 seconds we have left, Kevin, does Congress do anything once Mr. Biden puts his hand on the Bible and takes the oath of office? Are they just going to be forced, despite everything you've outlined for us, are they going to be forced beyond the $900 billion thing here if that gets passed? Are they going to need to do another $2-3 trillion here?
Yes, they have to. So the only way they do that is we're looking at the prospects of the Treasury Secretary and the Fed Chairman negotiating with our creditors to allow the Federal Reserve to print new money. We're talking about a workout for the United States of America. The bond vigilantes that terrorized Greece, you know, 5-10 years ago.
Oh, I remember that. Yeah.
They're here right now, and that's the story of next year. Because if they don't do the stimulus, the U.S. economy will enter into a cold age, right? Because it will affect the rest of the economy.
Sure.
The whole economy has to have all of us producing, all of us consuming in order to grow. Otherwise, it will collapse.
Absolutely, top to bottom. By the way, Kevin's book, you can pick it up on Amazon, Onward at Last, a tome on behalf of our progeny. His website, theuniversalonenessblog.com, economic analyst, Army veteran, law degree from UConn, Kevin Howard. Kevin, thank you. Have a wonderful holiday season. We'll talk down the road. Thank you.
I look forward to it. Thanks so much, Paul.
Thanks, Kevin. Appreciate it. Kevin Howard, law degree, UConn Law, economic analyst, Army veteran.